picking up where he left off about he had the opportunity to go to the Olympics.
Yes, I did have the opportunity. I had beaten the fellow who did end up going. His name was George Saunders from Ontario. But anyway, I would have had to give up my job at NATE and go to a training camp in Minnesota for probably 3 or 6 weeks. And I had been away the year before, taking a group of wrestlers from Edmonton, and we went through 5 countries, to West Germany, Romania, Bulgaria, and Turkey. And the year before that, I'd been to the World Championships in Argentina. And so, well, my wife and I decided to stay home. But anyway, maybe somebody had a plan for me, because if I'd have been there, that was the year that the assassins came into the, this was in Munich, wasn't it? Mm-hmm. Yes, yeah. And they came in, and 3 or 4, I believe, wrestlers were killed by the assassins. And anyway, so anyway, maybe that was a good thing, because things have turned out well here, mm-hmm. back here, and things are still going well mm-hmm. back here. And I'm going to talk about hostel life.
Oh, okay.
I lived at the hostel. I don't know whether people know what the hostel was. You know where it was?
I do, yeah.
And of course, the boys and girls hostel mm-hmm. worked together. So it was 1960. And, well, my dad and I had a little bit of falling out, and so I left and I was on my own. And so I went up, and a guy...
how old were you?
I was, I think I was 17. Mm. 16 or 17. But anyway, I was in grade 12. Mm-hmm. And we had to take two years of grade 12 back then. Because when we came from Perryville up to Athabasca, everyone had to repeat math 10, science 10, social 10, and English 10. And so that meant that we had needed 2 years. Mm-hmm. And so, anyway... But the hostel was a wonderful place to live. It's quite an experience for a young guy. Mm-hmm. It would be like a residence today say, at the U of A.
Right.
But it was really an eye-opening experience because I believe the boys' hostel was run by the Anglican Church, and the girls was looked after by the Catholic Church. Okay. And the boys and girls... you weren't allowed to go, unsupervised.
Right.
We would go, if you want to, you could go and have lunch, walk down from the high school and have lunch mm-hmm. at the girls' hostel. Mm-hmm. And they'd invite us over 2 or 3 times a year for a dance and or whatever. But the meals were cooked at the girls' hostel. And they were carried over in big trays. They were brought over to the boys. So we had the boys' hostel we ate at the boys' hostel.
Didn't make the food at the boys? They brought it in from the girls?
It was served there, and then we did our dishes and washed everything up, and we took it back. And, mm-hmm. and it, of course, everybody had to do their duties. There were special duties that you had to do. Mm-hmm. We had to take care of it. And
when you came in... from Rochester to Athabasca to go to school?
Perryvale.
Oh, from Perryvale, right. From Perryvale. Which school did you go to?
Edwin Parr.
So that was up on the old...
Yes, yeah. That was a pretty new school then.
Right.
Okay. I think Edwin Parr was started in 54.
I think so, yeah. That sounds about right.
So, this was 59 or 60 when I started
there.
Okay,
so
it was, yeah. So... It was totally different. It was added on to and upgraded many mm-hmm. times over the years. So anyway, just to get you familiar with, and of course the Anglican minister, Reverend Gibbons, he and his wife and family lived really partway in between the two hostels.
Oh, okay.
So
it was the hostel right at the church, or was it a house that they had?
No, the hostel.
Yeah.
No, it was a house, a big house, and it's still there. The boys' hostel is still there.
Oh, is it?
Yeah, okay. It's right about halfway from the United Church and the Legion, right across the street from the.
Right. Okay.
Yeah, it's still. I think it's still painted green, and I'm not sure what it's used for, but.
I think it's somebody just lives there.
There was about 14 or 15 boys there, at least. And I'm not sure how many
girls. So, to go to school, did you guys just cut straight up the hill through the bush?
Yeah, there was a walk down there. You didn't have to walk the sidewalk. You straight down a hill. There was no pavement there, or just a trail. And but I usually didn't go home for lunch. We'd have a sandwich or something and make it. And so I stayed. But I was able then to play baseball and get to practice. And I was playing with the senior men's team at the time. And we had wrestling. Dick Baker, he kept us for wrestling.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a job. I worked I was in show business. Yes, I was. I cleaned the theater, anyway, for Mr. Richard Hall, and of course, then I got too busy, so I gave that up. But I was in show business for pretty near a year.
Okay.
I guess you call that show business.
Sure.
Anyway, but at the hostel, everybody had duties. Like you had to, the showers had to be cleaned every day. And there was bathroom duty, and there was sweeping the stairs, and there was in the wintertime shoveling the snow, and cleaning the halls, and and there was a I can't think of the name now. well, you had to go to church every morning, and you just go in and sit down and have time to put your thoughts together. And taking out the garbage and things like that. But I'm going to tell you a little story about that. There was a fellow there by the name of Robert, and he set this all up. Now there were matrons there. We had they were elderly people, but they were the matrons, and they made sure that everything, people did what they were supposed to do, and things got done, and people behaved themselves, and I forget their name now. Maybe I can remember that at a later date, but. So they would do an inspection in the evening after the dishes were done and things were put away. They'd do the inspection.
Were they nuns or were they just people that were hired?
No, just people that were hired. People, elderly people who had good values and. So anyway, and this fellow's name was Robert, Robert Silverthorne, and he kind of set it up to pull a little fast one on them. So anyway, he'd done his little bit of fooling around, and everybody kind of knew what it was. So they were there to laugh when the custodians the matrons came. But Bob, somebody went to the matrons and said that the bathrooms are in terrible shape. Whoever was supposed to do them didn't do them right, and they're a mess. And sure enough, they were a mess. So the matrons came and they looked and what is this? And of course, Bob with the toilet, and he said, well, what's going on here? And he said, well, Bob, look at here.
Mm-hmm.
And Bob said, well, he said, I'm going to use this as a bad SHIT.
Okay.
He said, he looked at the toilet and he said, well, yes, it looks like shit. And he went over and he said, it smells like shit. And he took his finger and he went, well, it is shit, he said. And of course, he put peanut butter on. Sorry.
Still braver than me. Even so, on a clean toilet, I don't think I can do that.
So anyway, but he was quite a character. And of course, another tradition they had at the hostels was... And I mean, it was serious business. You had to go to school, and you had to keep your marks up, or else you couldn't stay. If you don't want to do your schoolwork and do what you're supposed to do, then you would be dismissed. But anyway, in the fall, it was kind of an initiation thing when you're starting. I guess I was only there a few days, and they had this what they called a young lady's undergarment. Raid, they called it a panty raid, and really there was nothing to it. But so there was a bunch of us went over there, and they pulled the the stairs, the fire escape stairs.
Okay.
We pulled them down, and people started making noise, and all of a sudden there was a bunch of screams. And and there was a bunch of screams, so nobody wanted to get cut. So away they went back to the boys' hostel. And, of course, Reverend Gibbons and Mr. and Mrs. Gibbons' place was right there. And Mrs. Gibbons had a long clothesline, and she had a bench underneath where she would stand up and put the clothes on the line. Mm-hmm. Well, the rest of us were ready, because we took off and as hard as we could go back to the boys' hostel. Well, Bob, he was going to take a little bit of shortcut, so he, instead of running around the end, he jumped the bench and he caught his neck on the wire.
Literally clotheslined himself.
Clotheslined him, absolutely clotheslined him. And he was out cold. He went down. And the guys, they didn't want him to get in trouble, so they went and drug him. They grabbed him by the pants or the heels, and grabbed him by the feet, and they pulled him and across the gravel road.
Oh.
All the way to the boys' hostel. So he looked pretty tough by the time he got there.
How long did it take him to wake up?
Because a few bounces
on the rocks.
I know. And there was, we never saw gravel out in the country, but there was gravel on the
right,
road there.
Right.
And so that was another little story about the hostel. So, but anyway, it was a great place to go. And but the other thing about the hostel is probably the only place in the world where you could go and of course, you know, you had to get up in the morning, get your clothes ready, get your homework ready, get ready for breakfast, because we had our own breakfast, we had cereal and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And but you'd go down to shower into the bathrooms downstairs where the showers were, and you'd never know what was going, whether you were Brill Cream, remember Brill Cream?
Mm-hmm.
Boys, we used Brill Cream.
Yep.
There would be, every day somebody would get it. Your Brill Cream would be in your toothpaste. Somebody would tie a bar of soap get that in there.
Right.
And you never know what was going to be done, but there was always something to somebody. And when you got in the shower, people would be waiting, and they would either flush the toilet, and mm-hmm. the water would get too hot, mm-hmm. or they'd flush they'd turn the taps on in the sinks, and you'd get showered in cold water. And when you got out of the shower, your clothes or your socks might be in a knot, your clothes were gone. So that was, it was quite a place, but it was a real experience for a young guy, and it was a real life changer, an eye opener. And it's an eye opener. They say that love is blind, but marriage is a real eye opener. So anyway.
But how many boys would have been there?
I think there was. It seems to me there was 16 or some 17, mm-hmm. quite a
That's
few.
That's enough.
No. Yeah, they always there was no bus running from Richmond Park up that way,
mm.
and so all of the children came. The school was closed, and so most of them came, and the girls stayed. There were girls and boys, and they would come. Rochester and Perryville boys would come, and girls, mm-hmm. and. Peace River, Fort McMac, Fort McMurray, Fort mm-hmm. Mac, all the other little places in between. So
Peace River seems like a long ways. Fort Mac seems like a long ways
well,
to come.
Well, yeah, but they would come and stay, but they didn't have much for high schools then.
Mm, okay.
There. No, that was, no, Fort Mac then was just maybe a hotel and a few houses.
True, yeah.
So anyway, that's my story about the hostel, those three little things, but... Just going to tell the story of my graduation in high school. And of course, when I came, the first year I went to EPC, I rode the bus. And of course, I would have to miss school because I was the only, my dad was away working all the time, and I was the only boy. So I had to put in crop and take off crop. And so I would miss 30, 40, 50 days of school a year. And so I became a better student when I came and stayed in the hostel, and my marks improved, and I worked hard enough in the matric program and got a university entrance average anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So as I told you, I only had I lost the hearing in my right ear,
mm-hmm.
and so I never had much to do with the opposite sex because I didn't want anybody to ever know that I couldn't hear another ear because I hid it. I had a defect or a fault, but anyway, when it came time to graduate in the fall of 1962, I was working for my neighbor down the road, and I was. I was working for Leto's, and I worked on the planer mill and the sawmill in the summertime. And so, anyway, I got this call one night because I was going away to university, and so I was trying to save, make as much money as I could to go. But I got this phone call one night from this Mrs. Hopps, and she said, "Hello, Larry," and I said, "Hello, Mrs. Hopps," and she said, "Congratulations that you're going to university and." And all this, and she said, "Congratulations!" But Larry, are you going to graduation? And I said, "Well, I think so." I said, mm-hmm. "We go to Wade University, and back then they didn't, unless you actually graduated, they wouldn't. You didn't go through graduate. You had to have your diploma or your your matric.
So you'd come back in September whatever.
Yeah, you'd come back if you went away to school in Toronto while you came back. And people usually did. It was a big thing. It was the biggest thing in town.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, "Well, I think I'll come back if I have a ride. I didn't have a car or anything." And she said, "Well, Larry, if you're going to go," she said, "Larry, do you have an escort? Do you have a date?" And I said, "No, mm-hmm. I don't." And she said, "Well, Vivian," her daughter was, she said, "Vivian doesn't either. Would you mind if you took Vivian?"
Mm.
And I said, "Well, I guess that'd be all right, sure. And she said, "Well, we must keep this a secret," she said. "Don't tell anybody, don't tell her, but I'll set it up on this end."
Mm-hmm.
And her cousin was Norman Ray, who was a good friend of mine.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, we'll just say that you phone me and ask me, and I'll set it on at this end. So anyway, mm-hmm. so everything went well. We went and picked, I had a fellow with a car, a friend with a car, and so we went and picked Vivian up and took mm-hmm. her. We were all dressed up in her Sunday going to meet and best. Anyway, and it was a great evening. We had went through the ceremonies, and then we went to the dance, and then we went to the lake, and it was a moonlit night, and we skied after 12 o'clock.
Water skied?
Yes, water. Wow. The girls didn't, but the boys did, and that's the first time I ever skied in my life.
Really?
Yes. And I got up for the first time I ever skied. In the dark. I've been in the dark most of my life. But anyway, so that was good, and I took Vivian home, and everything was mm-hmm. wonderful. And of course, I never said a word to anyone until about 35 years later when I came up and I was teaching here.
Mm-hmm.
I come into the Happy Garden and for a meal, my wife and I, and there was Vivian sitting there, and I hadn't seen her for a long, long time.
Mm-hmm.
And I went up and her husband was with her, and I said, "Vivian, I want to thank you for being my escort or my partner on mm-hmm. at graduation." And she said, "Oh," and I said, "Did your mother ever tell you?" And so then I went and told Vivian what had happened, and she said, she was so red, and so she said, "If my mother was alive today, I'd kill her," she said.
Oh.
But I never said anything, I never told anybody, and mm-hmm. her mother never told anybody, but that was my escort for the graduation.
Right.
Yeah, anyway, we've always been good friends ever since. But
good.
She works out, she lives at Baptiste Lake, husband's mechanic, and
mm-hmm.
yeah, and she had family, and we had family, and so that was the story of my graduation night date, and everything went well. So I'll just go back a little bit. I may have told some of this before, but when I was a young fellow, things had happened that like I was born with a with a kidney that did not drain, the tube that drained from the kidney to the bladder grew in the wrong place. And so I always had a kidney, an ache in my side there. And the only way I could get it put down, put a pillow or my arm underneath it. Like if I was sitting at a desk, I'd be able to do that.
Lean against it, right?
And so we never discovered what was wrong. The doctors of the day just said it was probably growing pains. When I was 33, my wife said, "Larry, we've got to go see a doctor." So sure enough, I went to a doctor, and she said, "Well, I'll send you to a specialist." And so they did, and they laid me on the table and put a dye through me. And sure enough, they found that this dye, so the dye indicated, yeah, there was a pinch there, there was a kink there. So they cut it and put it in the right place and back together, and it's been, it's still there, but I don't have the pain anymore. So I had that, and they got that fixed, but when I was three, I had the ear infection and the problems that, and but the eardrum broke, and of course in those days there was no sulfa drugs, there was no
right
medication, and going to town to Athabasca was an all day trip and more, so with a team of horses or whatever. So I didn't realize that I couldn't hear until I was 10, 11 years old, and I hid it then, and when I found out, and I think maybe I mentioned before that I went through 12 years of public school and never put my hand up and asked a question, because I was afraid that the teacher or somebody else might have asked that question or put the answer to the question, so I hid it, but I came pretty good at lip reading, and if I was asked to come into a group, I stood so my left ear, my good ear, was available. So I became a pretty good listener. But my mother always said that Larry hardly ever spoke when he was a young kid, but he sure made up for it later on. Anyway, but I'm old enough to know, I remember coming to Athabasca at one time, and that was before when they still had the ferry, before the bridge was built. And I remember riding across in the cage. I think I'd gone across on the ferry, and then we were looking at something, or I'd thrown rocks on the water, and the ferry went back, and so I had to take the cage back. So I do remember that. And also, I'm old enough to remember my neighbors. My dad had a little 9N Ford tractor. And that was we pulled a two-bottom plow, and of course, when all of us kids were, we got to do that, to drive the tractor. But my neighbors still plowed with a team of horses and a one-bottom plow, and I thought that was wonderful to go and watch that furrow turn over, and I would walk behind my neighbor, Jim Hanna. He would use the horses and plow and of course, sometimes the furrow would fall back, so I'd walk behind, barefooted, and shorts on, I guess. And if it was hot, you'd just sit down, and your legs would cool down because the dirt was always cold. And I'd flip that over, and every once in a while he'd stop and he'd give me some tea and thank me for doing that. So that was really something as a young kid, because I remember being barefoot every summer till I was probably 13 or 14 years old. But working with horses, my neighbors cut hay with a team and a little 6 or 7 foot horse pulled mower. Mm-hmm. And we used to have a rake, and we would, and we even cut with that mower. And we had a rake, a dump rake, where you went crossways and then you dump, go around and around the field, but you dump it in the same spot. As soon as it was full, you dump it, and then you would come kind of push it up together. And we used a barge to throw the hay in and then pull it. It was like a small corral, only you could swing the gate open when you finished and leave. You could pull it off to the side of the field, and there was fingers on the bottom all the way through, and so you could Just take the undo the end and jerk it, and it would pull out, and there you'd have your stack of hay there,
right? Oh, okay.
At the edge of the field. So, and then in the wintertime, you'd go and pick it up and bring it home.
Mm-hmm.
And or you'd use a hay rack and you'd throw it on. And mm-hmm. I remember as I was working for Mr. Nickel across the road, and my brother, he'd hired my brother Donald to throw hay up, and they had me tramping.
Mm.
And this one time I was they had quite a load on, and I was tramping the hay, so you get more hay in, and I didn't hear, but he told the horses to get up.
Right.
And so they went, and I was in the back of I went right over backwards,
oh.
And I landed on the back of my neck and shoulder,
oh.
And I thought I was going to die. Now, that was some kind of a feeling, because it knocked all the wind right out of me. Oh, I'll tell you, I learned never to listen for the when the horses
You're
were
lucky
running.
You didn't break your neck.
Oh, I know.
Yeah.
And that, it wasn't a high-wheeled wagon, but it was larger than the wagons we have now, that was higher.
Right.
And, of course, it was above the rack at the back.
Because he'd been stamping.
So I would have been about 8 or 9 feet that I flipped and landed. So anyway, that was another lesson learned. But I could have easily broken my neck, I guess, for sure. And then of course, we had the fire at home when I was young. I was 5 years old. And then I went and lived with my grandmother for more than a year, I guess. And,
mm-hmm.
But during those first few years, I remember my grandmother would get, she taught at Willow Ridge, and she would bring me in at Christmas concert time, and they needed a baby. Maybe I was baby Jesus, I don't know. But I remember being in the Christmas concert. And of course, in probably January or February of that, and that would have been 47, I'd just turned 5. Well, I was going to go to Perryville the next year, and of course the school was Lewiston, and because they take you in for orientation. And so I remember going, and there was right east of the school, there was a big hill down there, and the school was named after the main family in the community, because the Lewises had started the community.
Okay.
That was a stopping place for the Lightning Trail teams and all the stuff. So all the stuff went through Perryvale, and but Lewiston. So I went to Willowridge School went to that school for a day or two, and Lewiston. And then when we had the fire on, I went and lived with my grandmother, and from April 9th to the end of June, I went to George Lake. She was teaching there.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the fall, they moved her to, because she was a very strict teacher, a good teacher. Maybe they needed something better than they had, or maybe the teacher left in Narrow Lake. So, but in the fall, that fall after George Lake, she taught at Narrow Lake.
Mm.
And so I went to school there with her from September the 1st till about the 15th of November. And then our house was getting ready, and so I moved back home, and we were a family again. So, but my sisters were lived with my grandmother, and my two brothers lived with my aunt and my other aunt and uncle. And so anyway, those were trying times. Mm-hmm. Those were difficult times. And then when I went to Perryvale, they had just built the new centralized school, and I think there were 5 rooms. And so I went to 5 different schools in a year.
Wow.
So anyway, those were interesting times, but they were good times. They were very good. They turned out well. Okay, 1966, I graduated from university and came out, and I had a job with Athabasca County, and they. So I worked at Landing Trail School. It was called Athabasca Elementary then.
Mm.
And actually, I was at the Old Brick School, because the students, the younger students, were going to school there, because the Collington had closed and Perryvale was partially closed. But anyway, and this was about November. I'd moved, and I was teaching math and science at the grade 7 at Athabasca Landing Trail School, or Athabasca Elementary at the time. And anyway, so it was time for the parent-teacher night. Mm. And and of course, I was the rookie teacher on staff. There's a lot of ladies there, and there wasn't a very gentleman. But anyway, so they said, Larry, you're the rookie. You have to look after the refreshments, make the coffee and tea and buy some cookies and donuts and have all that ready. And I said, okay, well, yeah, I guess it's going to be my job. And so I went and got everything. And I asked some of the responsible students to go into the staff room, and where the coats were hung, the urn was down in there. And of course, they did, and I got the donuts, and I was setting everything up, and of course they brought the urn in, they filled with water, and we put the coffee in, and the coffee was good, and everything went real well. Nobody complains about anything. The food was good, the drinks were good. But anyway, now I have to go back and fill in the story that I, for a few weeks or so after that, a week or so after that, I could not find my socks, because I had to change when I taught phys ed to math, and so I could not find my socks, and I used to change and bring my stuff and put it where the coat clothes hung, and the urn was down underneath. And anyway, so I looked for them. I couldn't find them, and my jockstrap might have even been missing there too. But anyway, so something else was coming up, and so I said, "I better check that urn." And sure enough, I went in there, and I told them to clean it and wash it out after the parent teacher night. And anyway, they didn't. They just stuck it in there.
Oh no!
So I went and got the coffee urn and brought it out and started cleaning it. And here were my socks in the bottom.
Oh no!
One of them just done it on purpose, because they wouldn't have been. But my socks were in the my sweat socks, and of course back then when you were young, I used to run with the students and teach them soccer and basketball and whatever. So they. So that's the story of the how everybody really appreciated the coffee, but I never did tell people for a long time.
I bet. They wouldn't have let you make the coffee again, no, for sure.
I would have lost my job as a coffee maker. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so that's another little story about one of the things that happened to me along the way. Now, another one is I went back to university and played football and wrestled again, and then I came out and I got the job at Rochester as principal of Rochester School, and everything went well, and I used to and my mother still lived on the farm then, but I think in 1986 she moved to town, and when she moved to Athabasca, she sold the farm and had enough money to buy a nice house in Athabasca. She lived up by the inn there, that nice area, real nice area. So anyway, but when she moved up, that was in 86, so we every time there was an administrator, once a month, we would it's not like it is now, we would leave at 3 o'clock, I could get the one period off, and we'd meet. And then later on, we would leave at noon. And but every day time I went, I would it would be 5 or 6 o'clock, and I'd stop and visit my mother, and just to have a good visit with her. And she'd, of course, I'd say, no, I'm just stopping for tea, mother. And she'd have a 2 or 3 or 4 course meal there. So anyway, and this one day she said, "Larry, how about a piece of pie?" And I said, "Well, okay." So she went down, she got a piece of pie, brought up two pies. And that's a good pie. She said, well, you want another one? I said, well, yeah, I'll have another small piece. Mm. And she said, well, Larry, I'll send this home with you. And she said, as a matter of fact, I got another one. She said, you can take the one that's partly gone, and another one, and I'll send two, and you'll have enough for everybody at home. So I said, sure. And of course, she just gave me tea and pie that night. I didn't have a full course meal. But anyway, I stayed, but I knew that Bonnie, she had taken our daughters were playing basketball somewhere or doing something. Mm-hmm. And so she'd gone with them. Oh, I know, she used to take them dancing. They had a square dance group. Some other people there, the Rochester kids all did square dancing. They'd go visit here and there. So on the way home, you know, you're sitting there, and here's this pie sitting here. And I just picked it up in my hand. And and by the time I got home, I had I'd finished that pie. And then when I got home, I was, there was nobody there to cook a meal, so I started in and ate part of the other pie, and then I ate the whole pie, and Bonnie was, it was about 10 o'clock, and so I finished off the other pie, and to get rid of the evidence, because I knew that Bonnie would, when visit mother would say, how was that pie, or something, and Bonnie said, well, what pie? So I got rid of the evidence, and Bonnie never did know that I took this pie home, but mother did mention one time that about the pie, and Bonnie asked me, and I said, well, yeah, I was hungry. I ate 2.5 pies of blueberry pie. Yeah, so that was, but they always laughed about, mother laughed, and my kids always laughed. Mm-hmm. But I was really a pie rat. So anyway, that's a little story about my days in the teaching profession. Probably one more here, and then you probably had enough of me doing that. When we were younger, now this goes back a ways. Now I hope I'm not being silly or but that was one of the things in the old days when you would, and small mixed farmers, you didn't have your own boar or you didn't have your own bull. If you had a dairy cow, some people kept a dairy bull. And if you wanted milk cows, then you had to breed your milk cow, whether it was part Jersey or part Guernsey or part whatever. But you had to breed it to, if you wanted to have a good milking cow, you would have to take it to a dairy bull. So anyway, my neighbors up the road and are back across from to the northeast of us, the Hannah children, they always walked to school, and mother fed them in the morning and she fed them at night. And so my mother had 7 of her own, and feeding 3 others was not very much. But anyway, Jim Hanna had to go to somewhere, but he asked his son George and my brother Neil and I to help George take this cow, milk cow, to get bread. And the farmers then, they usually had 2 milk cows. One would freshen in the spring and have a calf and a new milk, and the other one in the fall. Mm-hmm. And so you'd have a milk cow all year long.
Gotcha. Okay.
And anyway, but this was this was later in the fall. I guess it would calve in the spring, because it's 9 months later. But anyway, so our job was to take this cow, and so we hooked up the team. George got that and hooked onto the wagon. It was a high-wheeled wagon, it was a high-wheel wagon, and they had a wagon box, and it was quite high. So, and then they backed up to they had a kind of a ramp, just a dirt ramp. And so you backed up to that, and then took the cow, and 3 or 4 of us could push that cow in the way, and then tie its head so it couldn't go either way.
Okay.
And so it was pretty comfortable in there, and to take it to Ferd Reinhold. Because he had a dairy bull, and this was about 5 miles away. And so we took our time, and you know, fairly didn't want to go over too much road because they were just trails then. There wasn't a road, there wasn't pavement, or anything. There was no gravel on the roads.
Mm-hmm.
So when it rained and you got ruts, those ruts stayed there all year. But but anyway, so we took the trails, the shortcuts, whatever we could, and so we got it up there to the bowl, and I think we stopped one place at his uncle's, and we had, but we also, two other fellows joined us, Martin King, and he was like an outrider, and Kenny Wilson, and so we had two guys riding horses, and George was driving the team, and I was just kind of watching the cow, and anyway. And I was the youngest guy there. But anyway, we got it up to Ryan Hope's, and we got the cow out, and the cow got bred, and we got her back on the wagon and headed for home. It started to rain a little bit. And so we wanted to hurry, so we trotted the horses a little more. And and of course, in the road, it was dirt, and so the dirt started catching on the wheels and coming up, and they had those... the scrapers were on the wheel, and so it would build up and it would start flying a little bit. And of course, then the guys that were on the horse, they'd come up and grab some of that dirt on, and they'd throw it at us. We had a dirt fight, a mud fight with this cow. And then, of course, George was trying to get away driving, and so the horses were galloping, and this cow was riding in the wagon box, and it was getting, and it was raining. And it was, and so we were having lots of fun, just about dying laughing. And I was hiding behind the cow, underneath the cow, over the edge, and throwing dirt back in their mud back at them. And anyway, the long story is that nobody got hurt, and it quit raining, and we got home, and they got the cow back. The cow was good, but that cow must have had quite a story to tell about her relatives there about going to the bowl. But anyway, but the cow was bred, and she was back, and so she would have had some real bull stories and some cow tales.
Right.
But anyway, that was the story, and we laughed about it. I laughed about that for years later, because somebody could have got hurt if you fell over. But there was good horses then, but those horses could travel too. They that team... When they were trying to catch us and throw mud at us, and George had those horses wide open, pulling a wagon and the cow in the wagon box. Anyway, so that's that story.